This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Although the Affordable Care Act's employer mandate for companies with 50 or more employees has been delayed, the health care bill could cause a culture shift for many businesses, whatever their size, as they sort through the details of Obamacare. This afternoon, we'll look at what businesses should be doing now to stay in compliance with the law. Joining me are Jolie Havens, partner with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Horan Vice President of Employee Benefits Services, Valerie Bogdan-Powers, and David Whaley, partner at Dinsmore & Scholl. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David, we have heard a lot about the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act, but what exactly is this employer mandate? Who does that specifically apply to?
So the interesting element with respect to the employer mandate is that it's only applicable to applicable large employers. So when we look at that, you actually have to be an employer of a certain size to even care about or deal with that mandate. And what it's saying to employers of that certain size, you have to offer to all of your employees qualified, affordable coverage. And if you don't offer qualified, affordable coverage to all of your full-time employees, you're going to face a penalty. So what we realize is we have this dichotomy or break, sort of a cliff above 50 employees and below 50 employees. So if you are an applicable large employer, you're really subject to the law and subject to those mandates. If you're not, you fall into an entirely different regime. There are clearly modifications in the Affordable Care Act to the coverage you'll deliver. But at the end of the day, the mandate that we've heard so much about doesn't apply to those smaller employers.
So it's 50 and above is considered a large employer. And that's quite a wide scale. I mean, is there going to be a difference between how an employer who's on the lower end of that scale would handle this compared to, say, a much larger employer, say, Procter & Gamble?
Yeah. So the interesting element, first to say, it's 50 full-time equivalent employees. So I always use the example. If I'm an employer and I have 1,000 employees that work 15 hours a week, because a full-time employee is a 30-hour-a-week employee on average. So I have 1,000 employees that work 15 hours a week. I have 500 full-time equivalent employees. So I'm subject to the act. If I have 49 individuals in my company that work 70 or 80 hours a week, I have 49 employees in my company, and I'm not an applicable large employer. So you have to realize there is that break apart in understanding pertaining to looking at different people in different places and understanding how we can deal with whether I'm an applicable large employer. But if we look at that standard, once you fall off that cliff, largely you're subject to penalty provisions. We do have some exceptions I talk a lot about. All of our penalties are based on actual full-time employees. So when we look at this full-time equivalency, the individual employer that had 1,000 employees that work 15 hours a week, they have zero full-time employees. So our penalties for an applicable large employer are based on actual full-time employees. They would have zero and owe zero penalties. But an employer that has actual full-time employees and is above 50 full-time equivalents is subject to the penalty provisions, but we have a catch. We have an out. Basically, underneath the penalties, you only pay the penalties if you have above 30 full-time employees. So some of those employers that might be right above 50 full-time equivalents may be able to manage their threshold with respect to penalties such that they're not subject to penalties, or they're subject to very small amounts of penalties. So they would be in a different place. So being right above that 50 or just below that 50 may be different, and it may not drive the choices.
I'm overwhelmed already.
I know. I think one of the things, too, you talk about that it's around the size, and there is that right as you're on that bubble, how it affects you. I think it's a lot about company types also, and the how many part-time employees are part of their business model. So if you're in an industry that has part-time employees, you're in retail, you're in the restaurant business, you're in a staffing agency, if you have a lot of part-time employees, they may not have been eligible for insurance before, and they are going to now count time towards your full-time. They can work over 30 hours, and they are now going to have to be eligible for an insurance. And so you can have companies that have 100 people on the plan today that have to add 1,000 more. So you're talking about a business model that has to greatly change how they're going to afford this or accept these penalties. So there's some big financial decisions for some of these firms.
Yeah, and what we really see with respect to a lot of our employers in conversations is that the biggest decision factor of whether or not and how we're going to deal with the Affordable Care Act is what we did before. Mm-hmm. When we weren't under a volition to offer any health care, what we did before will often drive how we're going to react. If I'm in the exact scenario that you were talking about, that we have a massive expansion of individuals, our analysis is going to look a lot different than if there were five people among 1,000 employees who didn't have coverage.
Right.
Jolie, what's your take on this?
Well, I think they're making some very, very good points. You know, a couple of things that I would add. In the applicable large employer calculation, one of the other considerations, and I apologize if this was already mentioned because I was piped in a little, you know, a little later, but would be the concept of affiliated entities. So if you are a smaller entity, but you are a part of a much bigger organization by, you know, control and ownership, then you do not get to count only your employees for purposes of whether or not you're a large employer. You are considered with that whole. So you could have some very small parts of a much bigger organization, which are then put into penalty land. Another point, which I think was a very important one, is the different way in which industries are impacted by the ACA. I think I use this example all the time that I think particularly retail, restaurant, hospitality, the way they may go about approaching ACA compliance is a completely different framework than the way, for example, a professional services organization might, where even in that instance, if you did not offer the coverage the way the ACA contemplates that you will, if you have individuals who are simply earning too much to be able to trigger a penalty on the exchange, then you as the employer are never going to incur any penalties. So I think that that differentiation based on what industry you are in and you know, within which you operate and what your service model is, I think is really, really important.
One other thing, Mark, as you talk about the size piece, is we have a group we've named them the Double Jeopardy, that when they do their employee count, they're over 50, so they're actually going to be exposed to penalties. But when they do their eligibility in terms of who's eligible for insurance, they're under 50, and they're going to get really underwritten in the under 50. So they are subject to penalties, and they're going to be on all the rules that small group businesses are part of, which includes community rating, deductible levels, no dollar limits on essential health benefits, things like that that add cost to the plan. And so there is that group, too, that we have to help consult through the changes.
Now, for lack of a better term, I guess the employer mandate was delayed, or that's a specific part of the employer mandate has been delayed. Why did that occur?
Largely the reporting requirements in connection with employers to be able to detail who among their employees were either offered affordable qualified care or not, or whether they were in fact full-time employees or not, was not built out in sufficient amount of time. And since it wasn't built out in a sufficient amount of time, there wasn't a means to actually, in reality, collect the tax. And since there wasn't a mean to collect the tax, there in reality wasn't an ability to be able to have the employer mandate kick in on 1/1/14.
I think that's absolutely right. I think one of the things that's most eye-opening for employers when you put it this way is that the way that the government was going to enforce the mandates, you know, both the individual mandate and the mandates against the employers in terms of the taxes, the employers were going to be the ones to give the government the information to do that. And I think he's exactly right that the build-out was simply not there. And because they couldn't collect that information, then it did not necessarily make sense to go forward with the employer mandate. That being said, we still are, albeit with a delay, going ahead with the individual mandate, at least as of now.
Now, when we talk about this delay, is that the pay-or-pay? Okay, the pay-or-pay aspect of the whole thing?
Yes.
Okay. And Jolie, what is the new date for that to take effect?
1/1/2015, which I think, you know, gave many employers who were, you know, perhaps some of the employers that we've been working with, you know, initially they were waiting for that Supreme Court decision. Is it going to be struck down? Then they were waiting for the presidential election. You know, is that going to change the name of the game? Then, you know, that doesn't come through. So they find themselves, you know, mid-2013 with, you know, perhaps some things in place. And a lot of employers actually, you know, are in quite good shape, you know, with respect to compliance with the government's mandates. But, you know, certainly some weren't, and particularly some of the businesses that are maybe just above that 50 level that maybe were not providing coverage, you know, prior to the ACA. I think they had a much needed moment to just take a breath once we got this delay. I think that, you know, they were, you know, overwhelmed by lots of things. I mean, we work in this area all the time, and it's amazingly complex and shifting all the time. But I think the message that I think we're trying to get back out now is, okay, you've had your moment to breathe, and it seems like you have a long time if, you know, the penalties aren't going to kick in again potentially until 1/1/15, but the reality of it is you don't. There are some things that I think it would be prudent for employers to be doing now and over the next few months to get themselves prepared for that 2015 deadline.
Yeah, and Julie mentioned, and I really agree entirely, and we're talking the same thing to our employers with respect to this, because I mentioned that we only owe penalties as an applicable large employer with respect to a term we're calling our bona fide full-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
And so what our challenge with respect to this is the law was written such that we really needed to guess right on day one of a year who our bona fide full-time employees would be for that entire year. And so the service, recognizing that that was not an intelligent way to otherwise administer the law, if we want to call it that, they really moved forward and said, we're going to give you a retroactive period to look back at hours of an individual to prove if that individual, if they have variable hours, is in fact a full-time employee. So what we do is we look backward to figure out if they're going to count as a full-time employee or a penalty-eligible employee forward. If with the delay to 2015, it means we're looking at 2014 service time for any variable-hour employee, a person who's paid hourly and their hours go from 40 to 35 to 28 to 27. It's exactly that group of people Jolie was talking about that work in retail and restaurants. We're going to be able to look back during 2014 to figure out for 2015's penalty purposes whether we need to offer them qualified affordable care to avoid a penalty.
Valerie, are businesses just now, are they plowing ahead, figuring the law is going to stand, or do a lot of them think it may go away?
No one thinks it's going to go away. They sometimes hope it is because it's requiring a lot more work for them. But they are, and we continue to advise, you need to continue to go forward with what's out there. I think with the delay, the other perspective is there's these measurement periods and different things they have to look at. But there's a lot they have to do now. The biggest thing they have to be doing now is all the budgeting for the increased taxes and fees that are hitting them. And that's very real for most of our groups. That can equal up to 4 to 6% increases before they even start their year. The other piece is they have to think about all of the new rules that are coming into their benefit plans. There's new maximum out-of-pocket rates. There's new deductible levels. There's all these pieces they have to consider. There's no limits on pre-existing conditions. There's different things that they have to budget for within the insurance they buy.
Well, after the break, we'll continue our conversation about how the Affordable Care Act affects companies and what they need to do to comply with the law. If you're trying to figure this out for your company, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email your questions or comments to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining me this afternoon are Jolie Havens with Vorey, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Valerie Bogdan-Powers from Horan, and David Whaley with Dinsmore & Shull. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jolie, how long have companies been preparing for the Affordable Care Act? Did they start right on day one, or was it a case of, let's wait, we've got time?
Oh, you know, I think that really varies by company, and I think that is one of the hardest aspects about ACA compliance is there simply is no one-size-fits-all solution. And in working with, you know, employers of different sizes and in different industries, you know, we see that every day. So I think you certainly did have those employers who, predominantly those that are maybe a bit larger and have the internal infrastructure to do it, that, you know, took charge of this regardless of their feelings on the topic and, you know, said we're going to move ahead. I think there are absolutely those that I mentioned earlier who hoped this was going to go away either by the Supreme Court decision, you know, presidential election and whatnot. And I think there are still some that, you know, every time we get these delays in mandates or any sort of tweak to the timing, I think that, you know, further contributes to that potential hope that, you know, I agree with Valerie entirely. I don't think anyone thinks this is going to go away entirely, but I think that belief that maybe there's a little additional time there or maybe there's a little bit more flexibility, you know, every time we have these changes, I think that kind of reinforces that. And then, you know, now we have, over the last couple of weeks, the new dimension thrown in regarding Medicaid expansion, you know, for Ohio employers. So, you know, it's I think the sand is just constantly shifting.
I think also, you know, if you think about the timing, and I think, Julie, you said it earlier, you had the Supreme Court decision. No one did much before that because they really wanted to wait. Then you had most groups renew their plans on 1/1. So you had fall where you're just trying to get to your January. and the elections. And so really, the majority of our clients that are small group and mid-market, which is the most clients in Cincinnati, they didn't really start looking at it till after the first of the year in 2013. And so as a result, we did a lot of impact analysis and really tried to start building the strategy. And along the way, as Jolie said, the sands shift because new regulations come out. Guidance changes to regulations, mm-hmm. and it wasn't exactly what the original guidance was. Things as small as exchange notices were due in March, we're all prepping for March 23rd, and then they're due October 1st. So they're just things that constantly shift that require these strategies to have to shift with it. And so it just is part of the whole formula for the employer.
So it's fair to say there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding this, and that's creating challenges for companies.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's a lot of it's around what are they required to do? What is the budget to do it? How many things do they have to comply with? And do they have the manpower and the ability to complete all those?
Yeah, and the challenge, the challenge that I see, and I think this is exactly where Jolie was pointing, is that our larger clients, our clients with thousands of lives and self-insured plans, have the staff and the wherewithal to otherwise begin planning on March 24, 2010. It's the employers that are in that small and mid-market who might be close to the 50 applicable lives for the being an applicable large employer that had the least, you know, resources immediately available to them. And they're probably the most impacted because there's so many cliffs from one point to the next where they fall with respect to being either subject to the law, not subject to the law, available to receive one of the subsidies from an employer basis or not. It's a part of community group rating as a small group or a part of large group rating with medical underwriting. They're falling underneath each one of these places. And as they fall, they're the least available to help or the least available to really work through that problem as compared to the large, large employers.
Right. And that's honestly where we spend all our time with our clients right now, which is, you know, great. We bring them the information. I had a little joke with my husband on this when we were doing so many seminars on healthcare reform. And he said, really, do people go to those? And I said, actually, it's our best attendance ever. So we can bring a lot of best practices. We can have employers share what they're doing because the information is just in time for a lot of these groups. We help guide them through that. But yes, they do get well attended, and my husband thinks that's crazy.
Kevin called in. He had a question. He works in real estate, and he wants to know, how does it affect somebody who's an independent contractor, but his company has over 50 workers? So does this affect him? Does this apply to him somehow?
Yeah, no, so the intriguing element, we've had this kind of not well-documented or not well-looked-at workforce of people who they refer to themselves as independent contractor employees, which in the tax world is kind of a joke because you can't mm-hmm. be both. You are either an employee or you are an independent contractor. And if you are an employee, you are included among the test to figure out if a company is above 50 employees. If instead you are truly an independent contractor, you're 1099 from your tax forms, you are self-employed with respect to the services you provide to a separate entity, and we typically think of most real estate agents in that vein, then it's as if you are one person. You are disconnected from the company you might be providing services through, but you are self-employed for yourself. And the great thing for that individual, they now have a strong marketplace to look for healthcare coverage. Before, when they did not have really any ability to shop for coverage, especially if they had a pre-existing condition. So in that smallest group, there really is a wealth of information available to the extent it does develop itself.
And David, I don't know if the audience would have heard the biggest change because you said no pre-existing condition, but starting January 1st, an individual will not be denied insurance. It's guaranteed issue. And that's very important because in today's world, if you're independent and you're not on an employer plan, you could be rejected based on your health conditions today.
And even more than that, your rates will not be set with respect Correct. To the fact that you have that condition.
Yep.
I mean, because there were some states that had guarantee mm-hmm. issue with policies that were $100,000 for 1 year of coverage.
Right.
But the reality of it comes down to now your rate is not set with respect to your conditions. It's generally set with respect to your age.
Right.
If you're trying to figure out the ACA changes for your company, give us a call at 513-419-7100. Let's talk to Ken from Bridgetown. Hi, Ken. What's your question?
Yeah, I was just telling your screener there that I have a daughter that works at a large grocery chain, and she's in college, and she works part-time. And, for example, back in the summertime when there's a lot of vacation, she's out of school, she was getting, you know, 38, 39 hours a week. And now they came down with a mandate a couple months ago that none of the part-time workers can work more than 29 hours a week, so they don't get up to the 30-hour full-time thing.
Yeah, that's an unintended consequence of the 30-hour rule that was put in place. And it's unfortunate because we're seeing that in a lot of employers where they're setting their policies around 28, 29 hours because
there's a dual cost to this, or there's a dual element to this, though, and I think it's really important to go all the way down this road when you mention it, because the immediate response is that isn't that terrible? The employer is keeping my hours at 29 hours a week. But if we think of healthcare as a part and parcel of employment, that individual who's at 29 hours a week is not offered qualified, affordable care from their employer, and the employer doesn't pay a penalty because they're a part-time employee. That means the individual can go to the exchange, get a premium subsidy, potentially a large premium subsidy, to be able to get insurance that's better than they could have gotten in the marketplace before. Realize that if that individual works 32 hours a week, is considered a full-time employee, and gets qualified affordable care from that employer, they lose the ability to get that subsidy, and at times will actually pay more for worse coverage from their employer. And so while losing the hours is a challenge, from an employment perspective or a total benefits perspective, at times it actually ends up being better off for an individual who's attempting to get coverage.
Jolie, you wanted to add to that?
Right. I think I was going to say, David, I think that's an incredible point. And one of the sort of perverse things that, you know, can come to pass in the employer benefits context, and we, you know, counsel employers on this point, that in determining your ACA strategy, there is, you know, sort of the math piece. That is, what can this employer afford to do, and you know, how are the penalties going to flow from that? There's obviously the sort of the non-monetary piece, which is the, you know, recruitment and retention of employees, employee morale, you know, all of those things, sort of that non-financial aspect of what we're going to do from a benefit standpoint. But even employers who are hoping to do the right thing and are trying to do the right thing can actually harm their employees from a financial standpoint, just as you said, by making them eligible for coverage that actually turns out to be more expensive for them than if they had gone to the exchange and gotten coverage and been ineligible under the employer's plan. I think that most employers, when we explain that to them, you know, they sort of have this blank look on their faces that they just, you know, they cannot really believe that that's the case. But I agree with you that it absolutely is.
I think you guys are absolutely right. And I think that applies to that group who isn't really, they're not eligible today. And so they aren't eligible for the employer contribution and the pre-tax status of the benefit. I think where we're seeing with some employers as we counsel them are for their employees that currently receive benefits from them. It's on a pre-tax basis and there's an employer contribution for them to go in and put their employees. So let's say they just want to drop insurance altogether, to put their employees in the exchange. Their employees will have a significant increase even with the subsidy, because based on their employer contribution today, based on the pre-tax status, they will not get the same amount as a subsidy, and or it'll be a post-tax basis. In
yeah,
the
and we've not seen one math scenario right. of an employer that provides generally full-scale coverage to the large wealth of its workforce, where dropping coverage is in the benefit of the employer or the employee.
Correct.
The math does not work, and it's mm-hmm. because healthcare is the most preferred tax dollar you can, or wage dollar you can give to an employee. It is free from FICA. It is free from Medicare. It is free from most municipal and state taxes. And suddenly, if I want to pay a penalty, realize that penalty is an excise tax. So if I'm a tax-paying entity as an employer, I cannot deduct that penalty. So $2,000 becomes $3,000. So $3,000 becomes about $4,200. So I'm paying tax on my penalty as an employer. And you individual, the amount of money I'm going to send you extra because I don't have to provide you healthcare suddenly is subject to FICA. It's subject right. to Medicare. It's subject to income, state, and municipal tax.
So is it maybe a case of being penny wise but pound foolish yep. with that thinking?
And I think one of the other pieces, if you're an individual going in to get a subsidy, the max limit is 400% of the poverty level. For a family of four, that's $94,600 approximately. If you go in, you still have to pay 9.5% of your household income to insurance before you're eligible for a subsidy. most people who are on employer plan are nowhere near paying 9.5%. They're more in the 2 to 4% of their total income going towards any sort of health care. So that also affects.
No, and I think this leads in the real answer, I believe, exactly is where Valerie was, is exactly where Jolie was, is that it really depends what you offered before.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on what your benefits offerings before the Affordable Care Act looked like to really figure out how your redesign to comply with the Affordable Care Act will otherwise look on January 1, 2015.
Absolutely.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And, you were talking about companies dropping insurance plans, how it's not in their best interest. What are some things that are in their best interest that are legal to do under the ACA?
One of the biggest things we're seeing is that a lot of employers are going to start embracing wellness and tobacco usage. And what the provision provides is that you can have a premium differential on both wellness and on tobacco. It can be 30% starting in 14, going from a 20%. And if someone's a tobacco user, you can have a 50% premium differential. And so a lot of our employers are saying, we need you to take care of your health. We provide a great benefit. We are paying for that benefit. And for those who don't, that's great, but we are going to charge a premium differential up to the standards of the law. And there's, you guys as lawyers can explain, there's a lot of other things they have to do. You just can't charge it. There's other pieces, but it's a big part of the strategy of what employers are doing today.
Yeah, and we're seeing a lot of the conversations on wellness programs. And I'm glad that it was brought up because wellness programs have a secondary bend. There was a Dutch study that was done a few years ago that basically found out that people that are healthy have higher healthcare costs over their lifetime. It's because they live longer. And since they live longer, they have higher healthcare costs. It turns out that if you're obese or smoke, you die sooner. And if you die sooner, your healthcare costs are lower, not on a per year basis, but an overall life care scenario. And so the question becomes, well, why do I want healthy employees if I'm only looking at this standard of they cost more because they live longer? But we live in the greatest shell game there can be. Because as an employer, your goal is not to have a question of people healthy or not. Your goal is to keep them healthy while they work for you. Because if they stay healthy while they work for you, and you're subject to a medical underwriting or a self-insured plan, so that risk comes back at you, then you're going to have better claims. You're going to look better. So our goal is to actually keep our employees healthy until they retire. And then it becomes, as an employer perspective, not our problem.
Okay. There's a lot, certainly a lot to consider with the employer responsibilities under the Affordable Care Act. And what is this doing in terms of added expenses for companies? I mean, certainly there's a lot more reporting that has to be done, a lot more record keeping. So it has to be a more expensive proposition, doesn't it?
I would say there's three areas of how it's causing more resources or expensive. The one that's straight out is the taxes and fees. The biggest one is the transitional reinsurance fee, and that is a very big tax, and it's taxing really all private insurance is going to fund the uninsured coming into the private public exchanges because they think they're going to have really a health situation that's going to require more money.
Yeah. Well, and realize that's a transitional expense. And mm-hmm. so it stops in 2016 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. 2016. Yeah.
And what it's really doing is you have to think about this. We had 40 million Americans without health insurance. And the reality is they did have health care. They would get it at the most inefficient place, usually the emergency room.
Right.
And since they were going to the most inefficient place to get health care, it was also the most expensive. So what we've done is we've said, hey, you 40 million, get coverage. And about 97% of them probably will. When it really comes down to it, we're looking somewhere between 90 and 95% probably get there. So we figure this out, and we have this group of people that's suddenly going to go to the system. But they're not going to go to the ER for today's emergency. They're going to go to the doctor for 20 years' worth of emergencies that they haven't dealt with. That's going to be a massive amount of expenses in the transitional reinsurance fees designed to try to offset that one-time flood-in cost associated with this group of 40 million people suddenly having insurance.
Right. The other major tax that's coming is a health insurer plan fee, and that's to the insurer, anyone who carries a fully insured plan. So the Anthems of the world and the United Healthcares are going to be taxed, but they are passing that directly through to the employer. So for when we look at presenting a renewal to our clients, 4 to 6% right from the start is an increase. Right from the start, that's your taxes and fees. And that is for the next few years, but it's a real cost to these employers. I think from a resource standpoint, the amount of compliance needed, how you're going to do your measurement periods, how you're going to do reporting. You know, I think David said earlier, the really large companies have very extensive human resource staff, and they're going to be able to figure that out. It's the middle market. So think of the 5,000, 3,000 and below, all the way to the small group that really are going to require a lot more resources to make sure they're in compliance, they're sending out the notices, they're doing their counting, they're putting the information into the W-2s that they have to do, the reporting back to them, all those pieces. It's money because it's people.
Well, and I think you said before, Valerie, we were discussing this, that the reality is the broker is now a consultant.
Yes.
Because of that nature.
Yes, we are.
Jolie, I was curious about something. Does the Affordable Care Act have any kind of impact on health savings accounts or flexible spending accounts?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we have gotten some guidance, and you guys pipe in on the impact of the Affordable Care Act. I'll tell you, that's not an area that I traffic in often, but perhaps, David, you do?
Yeah. So the first immediate impact with respect to flexible spending accounts is that the employee elective deferral can no longer exceed $2,500. Now, realize the mass of our employers probably had limits that were below that anyway, or at or slightly above, but we now have a hard limit. So whenever you think of a flexible spending account, that's the money you put away. At the beginning of the year, your employer comes to you and says, hey, how much do you want to put away for your health, your own cost with respect to healthcare? Well, I'm going to put away $1,000 because my deductible is $1,000. Suddenly, that number cannot exceed $2,500. The secondary change in the law was to HSAs and to FSAs. We used to have the ability to utilize those for any medical expense, over-the-counter or otherwise. And so there was an immediate change to say, no, FSAs and HSAs can now only reimburse medical expenses that are prescribed or are insulin functionally. Realize what that ended up doing was a bunch of Claritin D now is prescribed. So there's a need to go to the doctor to get a prescription to get your Claritin D for the over-the-counter. Interestingly enough, flexible spending accounts were allowed to use this for over-the-counter medicines, largely because of Claritin D. So it's an entire flip side scenario that we are now costing more for that which was intended to cost less. Those are the two immediate changes. Other than that, we do see some changes inside of the defined contribution healthcare system. You're not allowed to set up an employer plan that pays you individual to go to the exchange and get a coverage. We used to have this theory. It was called a health reimbursement arrangement,
right,
or a premium-only health reimbursement arrangement. We employer would throw $5,000 into that bucket and said, hey, go talk to a broker, get an insurance policy. We're no longer allowed to do that effective as of January 1, 2014.
We'll continue our conversation on the Affordable Care Act after the break. How is your company handling the changes? Let us know at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. In about 13 minutes in Focus on Technology, Ann Thompson is going to tell us about accessorizing Halloween costumes with scary and cool technology. And meantime, we continue our conversation about doing business under Obamacare. My guests are Jolie Havens with Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Valerie Bogdan-Powers with Horan, and David Whaley from Dinsmore & Shule. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, emailing talk at wvxu.org, or finding us on Facebook or Twitter. And David, you started to touch on this in the early part of our conversation about now there's a certain level of coverage that employers are going to have to provide to be in compliance with this employer mandate. Do we know specifically, I mean, do we just have generalities or are there specific guidelines for this?
There actually are specific guidelines. And so we often say that to get out of the penalties and realize we're talking about an applicable large employer, so an employer that has over 50 full-time equivalent employees, has to offer what we call qualified and affordable care. So to be qualified, the plan has to have a 60% actuarial value. And a 60% actuarial value means the product. Now, let's ignore premiums, because premiums aren't a part of this equation. It's the product itself pays for functionally 60% of the claims that are otherwise paid for underneath the program. It doesn't mean each dollar has 40 cents from an individual and 60 cents from an insurer. It's an actuarial average of 60% of the claims paid. Then the individual has to pay for 40%. So how does the individual pay for their 40%? Through copays, deductibles, co-insurance, prescription copays, that's their 40%. Now realize, whenever this first came out, we kind of all had this moment of, oh goodness, these plans are not going to be qualified. It turned out that 98% of the plans that were offered before the Affordable Care Act met the standard of being qualified. Now, secondarily, they do have a baseline coverage that they must offer. There are 10 different categories in which they must offer the coverage to be, quote, qualified. But generally, we end up seeing that there have been changes in the offerings that are underneath those programs, but the actuarial equivalencies really weren't that challenging to hit.
Right. And I would tell you, on average, for we've done a lot of analysis for our employers, and on average, our employers were in the low 80s. So they had good plans, and that would be considered a gold plan. And so what could happen over time is we do have some employers taking a strategy where they're going to offer an affordable minimal plan, and they're going to have people buy up to the other plans. So time will tell how employers decide to compete and use this as truly a retention and recruiting tool, because you're going to have a range where you're going to see some employers say, I'm going to offer a very rich benefit and I'm going to talk about it and advertise it, or I'm going to offer this minimal value plan at the minimal affordability.
And those are one of the strategies we have to pay attention to, though, because the law actually had a non-discrimination rule with respect to fully insured products. Before the Affordable Care Act, only self-insured products had a non-discrimination rule, meaning you can't treat highly compensated individuals better than you treated everybody else in the workforce. Now it's going to apply to fully insured products. It was supposed to apply January 1, 2011. About November of 2010, we received a notice from the IRS that said it's delayed for a while. A while still is now. We still are waiting guidance, and we're not exactly positive when that guidance will come out. And all indications from the service with respect to it is they're having a very hard time, because the challenge is, exactly as you mentioned, Valerie, if I'm an employer and I offer 2, 3, 4 plans to you, am I offering a uniform availability of plans to everybody, and what people select is their problem? Or do I have to actually test which plans your employees take? And if your highly comps take the very good plan, is suddenly the very good plan discriminatory vis-a-vis the lowest plan available to make sure you have qualified affordable coverage?
Where does the notion of the Cadillac plan, we used to hear a lot about that, where does that fit in?
And honestly, I probably will defer, because I've ignored the Cadillac tax, thinking that Congress will eventually solve this problem.
I think most of us have.
Yeah, we have. We've said there's a lot of administrations and elections before 2018 when the Cadillac tax.
You know, but I like to get into the example of the Cadillac plan, and at times Congress is not being ready to make this discussion. The Cadillac plan is designed really to provide a tax on the top 5% of plans that are offered in this country. It was designed to offer tax on the C-suite plans. So we throw in a number of $18,000 and change. Well, it turns out about 50% of the plans inside the country should be at that level by 2018. Congress not quite understanding that they had then just taxed half the plans in the country. If we do have a Cadillac tax, and this is prognostication and guessing what happens in Congress, which I know everybody goes wrong every day with, but if we do have a Cadillac tax, my guess is the number will be substantially in excess of the number that's there today. I think there's a large belief that it will probably just be out and out repealed.
Jolie, probably true.
Jolie, do the ACA rules change state to state, or is everyone under the same guidelines?
Well, I mean, you've got the federal basic law, which, you know, is applying across the board. To the extent, depending on how you set up your exchange, you know, there may be some variation state to state on that. One point that I was going to follow up on that Valerie made earlier, which I think is a good one, is talking about the strategies that we're seeing some of the things that we're seeing our employers consider, you know, in terms of compliance with the ACA and plan design changes and things like that. She mentioned the buy-up option. And I just wanted to mention a couple of other things that we're seeing with some of our clients, to the extent you guys are seeing them also. We have some employers who are considering subsidizing only employee coverage. So we will, you know, pay either full freight or a large subsidy for employee only coverage. But if you want family coverage, we're not going to subsidize that. And the way the penalty framework is set up, that's okay. That's not going to create problems for you from an affordability standpoint. We are also seeing some shifting related to spousal coverage. One of the basis of the pay or play penalties that we're talking about is the requirement to offer affordable and adequate coverage to all of your full-time employees, or substantially all of your full-time employees and their dependents. But we got guidance telling us that dependents means children. Dependents does not mean spouse. So therefore, there is no requirement under an employer plan to actually offer coverage to a spouse. We're not really seeing our employers pull back the spousal coverage, but we are seeing them implement some additional charges. So for example, if you have a dual working couple and one, let's say the husband, for example, gets coverage for both he and his spouse through his employer, if the wife has coverage through her employer, then what we're seeing is the husband's spouse charging extra.
Yeah, and,
because they're saying, well, you could go get coverage through your spouse, but instead you're getting it here.
And, Julie, I would even go so far.
You're going to pay extra for that.
Yeah, and we're even seeing so far as to actually see spousal carve-outs. When a spouse has a coverage available to them, they are ineligible under their employee spouse's plan.
Yep.
This is complicated. Where can a company go to get help? Is a normal tax lawyer or an accountant able to handle all this? Or is this something that's going to require a whole new specialty, ACA specialists?
I mean, I think I'm a little biased, but at Horan, we provide the counsel to our clients. We are their benefit advisors, and what we do is work hand-in-hand with their tax accountants and with their attorneys to guide them through. The more complicated the case, the more they'll have their own attorney come in. The less complicated, we will provide the overall compliance guidance. So I think that, again, I'm very biased in that. I think when you get to larger employers, the law firm and the tax accountant and the advisors are probably more of a straightforward team.
Yeah, and we've seen a lot of activity always from the large national consulting firms, to name a couple.
Don't say their names.
Please don't.
Yeah, but the reality is there has been a wealth of large national consulting firms. The problem is they have not fit into this small middle market space.
And
the reality is we see brokers growing into consultants is what we're seeing.
You're right, David.
I think one of the other pieces, too, that we're seeing is, you know, not only do you need your team of outside advisors, you know, you need your benefits consultants and your lawyers and all of that, but you also need to develop a team approach with, you know, internally.
Mm-hmm.
And we say that as being, you know, your HR folks, your benefits folks, your IT folks, you know, who are going to maybe need to set up new systems for tracking and reporting information. We also strongly encourage, although this is a bit different from maybe what you see in some, you know, pre-ACA benefits scenarios, but involving some of your executives.
Especially your CFO, Jolie.
Right. Many of these decisions that are being made, one, have a very, very potentially high price tag associated with them and could have a significant impact long term on employee retention and recruitment and, you know, all of those things which are, you know, again, not the financial side, but are still incredibly important for many employers. So I think assembling that team of people is incredibly important to ACA compliance.
Yeah, I've sat down with more IT departments in the past 2 years than I had the entire wealth of my practice career.
Right.
Valerie, what's your advice to a company that says, I got plenty of time, this doesn't take effect till 2015?
You need to call me tomorrow. You don't have plenty of time.
Now, what are some things that companies, you know, you're talking about getting your team set up to handle this. What are some other things companies can do to handle this?
I think they have to know their overall benefit strategy. David emphasized it, Jolie emphasized it. Why do you offer benefits today? And you have to really understand that, because that pathway then opens up what are your choices within the marketplace in terms of how we're going to execute that strategy. And it sounds trite and it sounds a little bit sassy, but I will ask employer, why do you offer benefits today? And if you can't answer that, it's going to be very hard to set a very good strategy in terms of navigating through the next few years.
Yeah. And I start every conversation with, what's our goal?
Yes.
And that's exactly the same place. What's our goal today?
Yep.
Oh, absolutely. And I think just getting them through that understanding that there is not a one-size-fits-all. There is not this, you know, wonderful plan that I can roll out for you that if you do these five things, you are going to be compliant with the ACA. It is unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, considerably more complicated than that. But at the same time, each employer also has some flexibility to craft a solution that works for them.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. Jolie Havens, partner with Vorey, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Horan Vice President of Employee Benefits Services, Valerie Bogdan-Powers, and David Whaley, partner at Dinsmore & Shule.